For Western civilization in the present condition of the world, the most important practical consequence of the guilt insisted in the liberal ideology and psyche is this, that the liberal and the group, nation, or civilization infected by liberal doctrine and values are morally disarmed before those whom the liberal regards as less well off than himself. I remember learning one manifestation of this attitude for the first time in practice in the same year that I met the female liberal to whose memory I paid tribute earlier in this chapter. I was teaching then at New York University, which was a pioneer in racial integration. Indeed, as a big university in so cosmopolitan a city as New York, with its large Negro community, the issue never really arose. I soon found out that there was an unwritten rule providing that Negro students should be marked about 2 grades higher than whites for a given level of work. If a newcomer on the faculty deviated in his innocence from this rule when he turned in his first midterm grade sheets, discreet words to the wise were communicated to him by his older colleagues, so that no lasting damage would be done by an unsuitable end-of-term grade that would have gone into the student's permanent record. One literal-minded young instructor, who refused to take those prudent hints, found himself the physical focus of the dean's office, the student's parents and uncle, a delegation from the NAACP, and a suave representative of City Hall. Naturally, the liberals on the faculty, that is, most of the faculty, had no difficulty justifying this rule to themselves, though they never did get around to recognizing it in public. The Negro students, they could explain, had come from inferior, usually segregated schools. They did not have an educated family background. Conditions at home were difficult. They had to work on the side. It was important not only for them, but for their people, the city, and the nation, that they should not be discouraged, and so on. Still, the fact remained, and this urbane New York University custom can be matched by 1,000 comparable practices today, yesterday, and tomorrow. I recall an evening not long ago that I spent with one of the country's most distinguished historians, who is a liberal à outrance. As the night wore on, he got somewhat more tight than was his habit, and at one point he remarked, more to his fifth gin and tonic than to the rest of us, "In the last 10 years, I've had several hundred Indians and Pakistani, and lately Africans in my graduate courses, and I've given out many an A, and never flunked any of them. And there hasn't yet been a single one who was a really first-class student." These academic forgeries are petty enough affairs, but often the moral disarmament is more startling and more consequential. Consider, for example, terror. I mean the terror that tortures and kills people, a rather pervasive trait of our time. The terror carried out by the French paratroops in Algeria, let us take a specific case, and subsequently by Europeans of the so-called secret army, aroused the full-scale, sustained indignation and protest of liberals in Europe and America. But somehow the indignation was less ardent, and the protest much muted, in the case of the terror that was carried out by the Arabs' so-called Army of National Liberation, though in point of fact, the Arab terror came first, was far more ferocious, lasted much longer, still goes on indeed, and has had 100 times as many victims, most of them, as it happens, fellow Arabs. The Algerian case is in no way exceptional. The Mau Mau terror in Kenya in the early 1950s, exercised almost entirely against other Negroes, was one of the most bestial in history. However, Western liberals never became much worked up about it, and were stirred to much greater passion and political activity against the stern and occasionally brutal, but incomparably less savage, police measures taken against it by the British authorities. There has never been a liberal protest against the outrages committed by the South African Negroes. There has never been a liberal condemnation of the savage terrorism that the Angolan revolutionaries unleashed in 1961 in their attempt to overthrow Portuguese rule in Angola, during which they killed thousands of persons, mostly Negroes, by burning, torture, sawing, and miscellaneous brutalities. The liberals' condemnation has been reserved exclusively for the Portuguese who fought back, perhaps for an unjust cause, but for the most part, without terrorist excesses. As with terror, so with colonialism. Liberal opinion has demanded and demands that the advanced Western nations, Britain, France, the Netherlands, Belgium, Portugal, liquidate forthwith all forms of direct and indirect colonial rule, without reference to economic or strategic interests, or the readiness of the peoples for independence, or the question whether independence will in truth benefit or harm them, or to any other factor save the abstract badness of colonialism. Liberals implement this injunction by giving political, propaganda, financial, and other practical support to the anti-colonial movements and their leaders, and by trying, usually successfully, to swing their own governments and the United Nations into action on the anti-colonial side. But when an underdeveloped nation goes actively colonial, when Nehru moves into Goa, or Sukarno into New Guinea or northern Borneo, there is at most a little clucking from the liberal backbench. No public protests, no letters to the newspaper, no resolutions in the United Nations, no invitations to resistance leaders, no committees to aid the threatened Papuans or Sarawakians, or whatever they are properly to be called. Analogously, in the United Nations, any amount of stupidity, rudeness, demagogy, barbarism, or sheer ignorance from a spokesman of the ex-colonial and other underdeveloped nations goes unreproved, and no reference is made to the tyrannical and savage deeds that may be taking place in his home country. Within the United States, as in other advanced Western nations, the same moral asymmetry is present. The liberal community not only flagellates itself with the abusive writings of a disoriented Negro homosexual, but awards him money, fame, and public honors. The spokesmen of the black Muslims can openly preach racial hatred, violence, and insurrection to their heart's content, with never a challenge from police, courts, or the self-appointed guardians of civil liberties. The guilt of the liberal is insatiable. He deserves, by his own judgment, to be kicked, slapped, and spat on for his infinite crimes. The shooting of a Negro in Mississippi, purportedly the act of a crazed and isolated white man, reverberates from liberal sounding boards into weeks of world headlines. The shooting of white men in Maryland by rioting Negro gangs slides back into an obscure and unread paragraph. The truncheons of hard-pressed police, struggling to preserve the minimum elements of public order against unloose chaos, become satanic pitchforks. The rocks and broken bottles of the mob, angelic swords. The force that blocks an entrance to a factory which a union leadership has declared on strike is a courageous defense of the rights of man. The force that might seek to use that entrance for its intended and lawful purpose is a cowardly blow by the hirelings of the privileged. Judging a group of human beings, a race, nation, class, or party, that he considers to possess less than their due of well-being and liberty, the liberal is hard put to it to condemn that group morally for acts that he would not hesitate to condemn in his fellows, not to speak of reactionaries. His feeling of guilt and his egalitarian principles, which incorporate and express that feeling, do not seem to give him the right to condemnation. Even if, because of an imperious practical situation, he finds himself resisting the pretensions of the underprivileged group, he does so with a divided conscience. If he has to shoot one of its members, and sometimes in the end he must, and rather more of them than if he had stood firm a little earlier, he feels a moral twinge that often spoils his aim as he pulls the trigger. When the Western liberal's feeling of guilt and his associated feeling of moral vulnerability before the sorrows and demands of the wretched become obsessive, he often develops a generalized hatred of Western civilization and of his own country as part of the West. We can frequently sense this hatred in the paragraphs of such American magazines as The Nation and Dissent, Britain's New Statesman, France's L'Express, or Germany's Der Spiegel. A Western retreat or humiliation at the United Nations or Suez, in Cuba or Space or Southeast Asia, becomes the occasion not for analysis, regret, sorrow, or stock-taking, but for vindictive and smugly pleased I-told-you-sos. In one of the critical discussions to which much of the material of this book was submitted as it moved along the production line, a liberal commented, after I had used the Algerian case as an example of the moral asymmetry, "It is true that there is among liberals this asymmetry of which you speak, this selective indignation, and it is true that in relation to the Algerian affair, the liberal protest was directed against the French para, not the fellaheen. However, this is in keeping with the highest dictates of morality, which has always decreed that we must be much stricter with ourselves than with others. The French are ours, fellow members of Western Christian civilization, educated and materially privileged. That they should descend to acts of terror, even if on a minor scale, deserves our moral condemnation much more than the terror of the Arabs, belonging to a different civilization, with ideals we deem lower than ours, for the most part illiterate and impoverished, and for a century and a half subject to the oppression of a foreign power." The force of his observation was somewhat weakened by the fact that this particular liberal happened to be not a Christian, but an avowed atheist of Jewish origin, who denies that Western civilization is in any respect superior to any other civilization, and who, in the Algerian affair, from the beginning identified himself not with the French, but the anti-French side. If his argument were valid, the realities of his own point of view should have led him to excuse the French and direct his condemnation toward the Arabs. But the argument itself, though it draws on a profound moral truth, is not really relevant to the problem to which it is here applied, and even if it were, it could not be properly used by a liberal. It is true that as a moral being, I ought to judge myself more strictly than others, ought to forgive others more readily than myself, and ought to be especially generous in forgiving the lowly and unfortunate, and to forgive irrespective of race, color, creed, or previous condition of servitude. But this means others as individuals and myself as an individual. The metaphor by which we extend moral categories to groups, a race, class, or nation, is doubtful and confusing. A group does not possess either intellect or will, the presuppositions of moral conduct, and is therefore, strictly speaking, outside the range of moral judgment, whether in praise or blame. And liberals, most particularly in terms of their own doctrine, have no basis for those moral distinctions among groups in favor of, specifically, the poor, wretched, and oppressed, that they do nevertheless habitually make. Reasoning from quantitative and atomistic premises, as I have noted, liberalism has always rejected Platonist, Hegelian, and other realist or organic conceptions of society that assign some sort of subsistent reality to the group. It makes a certain amount of sense for a Hegelian to speak of the historic guilt of this race or that empire, or the moral claim of that people, but it makes no logical sense for a liberal to do so. It is the guilt, not the reason, of the liberal that is being expressed in these attitudes. Moreover, whatever may be the respective crimes, virtues, and deserts of various races, classes, and nations, civilized society requires a certain rule and order to hold back from the edge of anarchic savagery where it is always precariously poised. Human beings must have at least a minimum security in life and property, must be able to move through the streets and between the cities, must accept certain common rules in their mutual intercourse, or civilization does not exist. If this necessary order is subverted, the civilization is destroyed, whether the subversion takes place from the best or worst of motives, whether or not it is in some supposedly moral sense justified, whether it is carried out by saints or devils. At some point, the guardians of a civilization must be prepared to draw the line.